even in the early years of the present century. Reading contributed tremendously to many aspects of human character. A wisely selected reading program informs the mind, elevates the thinking, and most of all, educates vocabulary. A person who reads good books has a better control of language and can express his own feelings more adequately as a result of having an adequate vocabulary. The reader also learned to spell and gained discrimination in literature. He became aware of what was a good book and what was not a good book. He also became aware of customs and policies and peoples and ways of life all over the world. He could become almost a universal citizen, reading quietly by the light of a gas mantle on his table. This is practically gone. Reading today is completely trivial in most instances, and more serious reading is devoted almost entirely to some form of skill or scientific knowledge, which we hope is going to improve our earning capacity. If we would take two-thirds of the time that we spend listening to bad news on television to a study of the basic literature of the world, a serious study of history, of biography, a serious contemplation of carefully drawn human characters as found in the writings of the great novelists and the great literary geniuses of the 19th century, we would come into a better relationship with life. We would have more tolerance for other people because we would understand other people better. Through Charles Dickens, you could learn to understand a great many people. And in this way also gain a certain tolerance for the idiosyncrasies of persons and realize why each individual is what he is and not resent constantly the fact he may differ from us in something. Art, music, all of these civilizing forces can be cultivated by discrimination. But if the discrimination is lacking, all these things simply become time killers. And the human being, whether he knows it or not, cannot afford to kill time. It is a very limited resource, and is the basis of the personal securities and integrities that he hopes to build. Also in this same problem, the problem of being quiet is a very serious issue at the present time. We live in a world that is full of noise. There's hardly a silent moment anymore. But more than that, we live in a world in which there is a tremendous amount of man-made unnecessary noise. One of the most common forms of this is small talk that leads to nothing. Arguments, dissensions, hatreds, and various accusations that are unfair or unreasonable. Somewhere along the line, the person who wishes to know himself must be able to sit down and become acquainted with himself. To each of us, ourselves remains always the unknown person. We spend very little time trying to understand our own motives. We simply fulfill the pressures. If we don't feel good, we let our bad feelings show. If we're angry, we explode in somebody's face. Nothing is really given any serious consideration under such pressures. So each person, beginning in childhood, should recognize the dignity and importance of quietude. The individual should be able to sit down and simply relax and think. Think without pressure. Think without intensity. Think in fields and areas which are comforting to the mind. Remember the better things of life and gradually discipline an appreciation for the benefits we have enjoyed, and also the gradual integration of patterns to contribute to the happiness and security of other people. A quiet, meditative relationship, a relationship in which peace of mind is the result of relaxing away from the stupidities with which we have become dominated. Everyone should be able to be quiet. It should not be necessary for the person who is not up to his neck in activity to sit back and simply fidget. There is no peace of mind where the individual cannot settle down quietly to contemplate or think or enjoy the benefits of his own spiritual experience and life. It is also through the quietude that we have to approach heaven. For whatever religion we may hold, whatever faith is important to us, we come closest to realities in quietude. And when we get nervous and upset and the blood pressure rises, quietude will bring it down again. Quietude also brings with it patience. The quiet person does not necessarily carry a chip on his shoulder. The quiet person is able to estimate more correctly the attitudes of others. It is much less likely we will misunderstand people if we listen quietly to their words or watch quietly their actions. Very often, misunderstanding is simply within ourselves. A prejudice has taken over and we spit back at someone. All these things create sickness. All of these things destroy the benefits of life. Now, with many people, there are two very important emergencies in life which have to be considered. One is the emergency that arises when children leave home. There is always that day when a busy life, made largely busy by the responsibilities of parenthood, this suddenly ceases to be an emergency or a dedication. The birds have flown. The individual suddenly finds a very serious vacuum. He has no longer the responsibilities, the anxieties and worries of parenthood. There is suddenly an empty nest and people who are unable to face it. They do not know what to do with themselves. And very often, the untrained, undisciplined mind has a tendency to sit back and contemplate its own deprivations. Very often it will contemplate why the children shouldn't have married the persons they did marry, or why have they not continued to write home every day, and why do we only hear from them when they want some money? Why are all these things suddenly brought to our attention, bringing about a feeling that we were never appreciated, that we have been left alone, we have given everything and gotten nothing, and on and on and on and on, until we can dissolve in a noble example of self-pity and go on sedations as the only remedy. Now, lots of people do this. They just cannot face the fact of life as it really is. They cannot say with cheerfulness, I have finished a responsibility and now my life is my own. The reason they do not want a life of their own is because they never had one. They do not realize that maturity implies the need for a personal existence. That things that perhaps were not possible due to the responsibilities of family had to be passed over. But now at middle life, it is possible to pick up all these threads and do interesting and important things. But if the mind simply will not rise to this occasion, then there are all kinds of false activities created, and we never fool ourselves with time-killing diversions. Unless we are really doing something worthwhile, we know it. And at that time, it is very necessary to think seriously of starting a second career or carrying on an early one. If at this time we have some leisure, some freedom from responsibilities, it may be that we should advance our education. But we should certainly do something that is intense enough to get our minds away from ourselves, so that we are no longer neglected parents, but are now adventurers going out in a pattern of personal accomplishments. A number of persons have made wonderful lives by simply picking up important threads when the responsibilities of the family where these responsibilities were lightened. Also, do not transfer all of this wasted energy and time on grandchildren. Do not spoil the grandchildren. Do not try to fill in by taking over their lives. Think always in a term of a life of your own. This means that sometimes you may be very helpful to the grandchildren, but do not let them take the place of children as a center of interest and an excuse why you should not do any thinking of your own. Now, the second emergency that comes along is the emergency of retirement. This is sometimes one of the most difficult of all. And that probably the difficulty is very largely to be faced by the wife. The man is suddenly home all the time. And it was bad enough when he was home at weekends. Now he is nervous, unsettled, and does not know what to do. He does not know why he is suddenly deprived of all of the original incentives of life. Because in the course of his business career, he practically forgot or neglected his own personal survival. He was part of a machine of some kind. And when the machine was turned off, he was left. Now, this in itself is always a matter of concern. A number of persons have found that it was possible for them to develop a third career, or at least a second successful one. There are many persons in their 60s who have suddenly found themselves fulfilling many of the interests and attitudes of earlier life, things that were frustrated or not possible. Many have formed new business projects of their own, have taken up or completed educational practices and policies. They have learned how to make and do various things. They have learned to simplify living, so that by having a smaller overhead and a smaller establishment, they are able to have more time to do the things they want to do. Then comes the question, what do they want to do? The answer to that very largely rests with earlier thinking. It's very hard to take that up all by itself at the end. It is much better for the individual to have carried along with his business career some other activity. The businessman and the housewife should have other interests that they have been developing over a period of years, so that the transition from one focal point of activity to another is comparatively slight. If there's no such an adjustment possible, a bewilderment settles in, and in this bewilderment, all kinds of false values take over. And the person gradually falls into one form of depression or mental chaos or another because of the lack of focal point. That a person should reach retirement age without a mind sufficiently disciplined to carry him from that point on seems difficult to believe, but it is very, very common. So that the undisciplined retiree falls into small purposes that have no real significance and no actual satisfaction for himself. Here, hobbies can be important, especially if these hobbies have basic educational value. Various projects involving social activity, in teaching, and in working with people, all these things can develop into useful extroversions. But most of all, if the person retiring at 65 or 70 has no interest in life, it is an indictment of his previous living, and it is also a hazard to his survival. A proper planned life after retirement from business can add 10 or 15 healthy years to the life of the person and can give them an opportunity for mental and emotional maturity that was they were deprived of during the long years of business involvements. So here are two periods in which it's very necessary to take over the problems of living and try to plan a successful long-range career. This is something that I think more or less reaches the summation of the situation, and that is the long-range plan for living. Not that the person is to live from now till the next vacation. Not that the person shall live from now until he buys a new car. But a long-range plan based upon a life of expectancy that for us here in the Western world will extend probably to nearly 80 years and sometimes more, a period of time in which a long-range plan worked on diligently from the beginning and forever in the back of the mind. This is very important. It is this long-range plan, for instance, that comes into the front of the mind when we sit quietly and do not think about transitory things. The long-range plan is something that should be filled with hope, filled with resolution, filled with dedications to various useful, constructive, and unselfish activities. But the plan should be there. And if necessary, when the person graduates from high school, he should begin to think about that plan. He should view it as a basic of his life, that he is a person, is living. He is going to accept the responsibilities of life. He is going to fulfill his responsibilities and his duties. But he is also going to be ever mindful that there is a reason for his existence beyond economics, beyond promotion in office or something of this nature, that there is a reason, and that is that he shall grow, that he shall finish this life a greater person inside himself than he was when he started. This is not a growth of ego satisfaction. This is not the fulfillment of ambition. This is not self-centeredness. But it is a fulfillment of what humanity is assumed to be here for. And that is to grow, to help, to be friendly, to be serviceable, and to be modest in requirements and attitudes. These are the things that should be planned for from the very beginning, so that along with all of the different responsibilities, the person does keep a small sacred core of intent within himself, that he is not going to sacrifice any responsibility in order to favor himself, but that in the midst of the fulfillment of responsibility, he is also going to realize that there is something inside himself that has to grow, that has to unfold, that has to mature, and that his usefulness to others depends upon the fulfillment of himself in a very large measure. If he can realize this and build accordingly, he will have a much better chance of escaping the doldrums from which we suffer today. We look around on all the levels of life, and these doldrums are closing in. We are frightened, we are worried, we are nervous, we are anxious. But most of all, we lack an internal core of integrities. Yet we have religion, we have enough ethics, enough morality, enough background in common education to tell us that there are certain things we should do. But they take a little effort. And the individual says, I have to work all day, I have to use effort at my job, and when I come home I don't want to work. I want to play. Well, it's all right, but there's no reason why we should not play creatively. There is no reason why our recreation should not be enjoyable and useful at the same time. because actually the final fulfillment of pleasure is the accomplishment of some kind of good that is going to enhance or increase the value of our participations in life. So that there is no reason why we cannot enjoy growth as well as or better than we enjoy escape from labor. Now, in the same problem, we find people in these difficulties are very often inclined to drift along. Now, there's a very narrow line of demarcation between an attitude and an affliction. The individual who holds wrong mental and emotional attitudes long enough will finally develop a chronic form, which may progress into something extremely undesirable. The individual will no longer worry because he feels he has something to worry about. He will worry because he can't help worrying. The problem is no longer important. It is becoming a mechanical process. Also, a neurotic gradually can drift into a psychotic. The moment we begin to develop wrong attitudes, we begin to endanger not only peace of mind, but health of mind. We become very close, perhaps, to mental disease. But the same is true of emotional disease. Very many people who, in one period or another in life, fall into the problem of a psychosis are persons who, from the beginning of life, never control themselves. They are persons who from the beginning had certain attitudes which were difficult. Most children growing up have at least one difficult attitude somewhere in their makeup. If this is not worked with, if not corrected, if no one does anything about the difficult attitude, it may linger and never appear in any major way. But it may, under adversity, come out with a torrent of pressures. The child who has always been dictatorial can become a dictatorial adult. A dictatorial adult will always finally face another dictator stronger than he is, and the result will be a collapse. We cannot allow any undisciplined attitude to take over. We have all kinds of beliefs, but these beliefs finally become finalities. You take a person who is very worrisome on some subject, and you say to that person, what is the foundation for your worry? What have you in the form of evidence, actual evidence, to support your anxiety? And very often the person has no direct answer. He's worrying because everybody's worried. He's worrying because the world's in a mess and everyone knows it. And he goes on with these generalities. But he does not have any clear indication or any clear process to explain his own attitude. It's just a generality depending largely upon the conduct of other persons. So under these circumstances, it is very important that the person shall take over an attitude the moment he finds it arising within himself. One of the simplest attitudes that we have to work with is prejudice. Now, to many people, prejudice is loyalty. Prejudice is necessary because it belongs to the group, or it belongs to the family, or it belongs to the theological structure to which the person belongs. Prejudice is therefore something which is very hard to cope with, but prejudice nearly always ends in trouble. Prejudice opens the person to every type of negative propaganda that can be launched against him by society. Prejudice destroys peace of mind and cuts him off very often from important, useful, and friendly people. Prejudice can affect the fate of his children. It can affect everything, his job, and everything that relates to his life. If he becomes locked in the concept that every dog is like the dog that bit him, he's in a bad way. There is no possible way in which prejudice can end in anything except sickness. Because health depends upon seeing good in everything. And sickness is seeing evil in everything. And the more evil we see, the sicker we become. And the quicker we come in contact with good that is appreciable to us, the quicker we begin a recovery. So we watch prejudice. And it's very scarce to find anyone who isn't involved in it in some way. The most common prejudices are religious and racial. But national, political, industrial, economic, educational, medical, all different fields are burdened with prejudice. And nearly every case, prejudice is a mistake. Now, that does not mean that the person has to become an easy believer, but rather that he must develop a discrimination that enables him to dissect and detect that which is proper and useful without generalizing on a situation in which generalities are too abstract and uncertain. Now, another problem involved is not only in prejudice, is ambition. Many persons are born Napoleons, and most of them end in Waterloo. Many people are quite convinced that by some circumstance beyond their own control, they are formed of a superior material. There was a special quality used in assembling their personalities. They will never be able to just simply be people because they were born to rule, to lead. Now, these people are, my observation is that many of these people are about the most unfit persons I've ever known. Instead of this prejudice being an expression of a great capacity, it is simply pure egotism. They are simply self-centered and overwhelm everything around them with the importance of their own attitudes, which are not important usually. And as a result of this, a great many of these highly ambitious people become utterly frustrated. They will never be satisfied with moderate success or moderate achievement. They must go on and on to the domination of society. People of the caliber of Hitler, Mussolini, Napoleon are examples of this tremendous drive, which ends in tragedy to themselves and disaster to the world. Therefore, the individual must be very reasonable in his ambitions. You should have ambitions which are largely aspirations. You should have the aspiration to become a better person. You should have an ambition to do your job well. You have a right to assume a reasonable advancement. But the idea that you are destiny's darling is going to cause trouble in most cases. The individual is frustrated and finally very often psychotic. And this moves often into the religious field. And the individual believes in a special dispensation that has been granted to him. And as a result, he becomes a nuisance to others and a disaster to himself. These things have to be watched. But the mind must be the sentinel. It must stand ever ready to evaluate things. It must judge. It must confer evidence, proper decision. It must work out all these problems fairly and reasonably. That's what it is for. When we do not use it in that way, we get ourselves into constant difficulties. Emotional intensity is also very often a matter of frustration. And in this field, affections are a very definite factor. People like to believe that they know what love is. Well, love is a very mysterious thing. People have been trying to find a definition for it from the beginning of time. And I believe, if I remember correctly, it was Voltaire who said on one occasion that the best definition he knew was that love was an itch in the heart where it can't be scratched. But very few people can really give us a mature definition of love. Love is usually, as St. Francis de Assis pointed out, is the bestowing of an affection, not the demand for it. The individual who gives an honest affection fulfills love in the best possible way. But the individual who loves himself better than the persons around him, and who is always finally in love with his own interests, his own attitudes, and his own emotions, can be a very sad character in the course of life. Love is something that requires a great deal of thought, or it can ultimately lead to the greatest despair, to emotional and mental distress that is almost beyond calculation. Love brings with it suspicion, which is very serious. It brings with it jealousy. All kinds of negative emotions and attitudes spring up. And everything then depends upon the internal adjustment of the emotions. Love asks nothing and gives all. And when it begins to ask a lot and give little, it has ceased to be a normal affection. And the individual who believes that normalcy requires jealousy or hatred is simply wrong. Love is a fulfillment. It is an ennoblement. It is a dedication of self to the service of something greater than self. Love of God is the service of that which is the supreme greatness. Love of religion, in the sense of our Christian faith or any other religion, is that a love is strong enough to make a dedication of service, that it is strong enough to cause us to change ourselves for the good of others. And where this type of emotion exists, you can work with it. But where love is a constant center, self-centeredness, we have people all the time who have had a disappointment in love, and 50 years later, the embitterment continues. Everything in life has been ruined by the infidelity of a person. Everything has been made terrible because we have a thankless child. All kinds of attitudes contribute to a gradual development of neurosis, in which we do not realize that the entire emotion of love is controllable by ourselves, and that it is controlled best when it gives most and demands least. If we can also then transmute problems, we are in a better way towards solution. Wherever a difficulty arises, it can be transformed from a disaster into an achievement. It is very definitely true that everything that hurts us most has a lesson that will make us better. We will find that in the meeting and mastering of circumstances, we gain the greatest consolation in the world. The person who has the right to be happy and is really happy is not the one who has never had tragedy, but one who has transmuted tragedy into soul power. Tragedy should make us greater people. Make us deeper, wiser, more loving, more understanding. Then it is a contribution to our good. If it ends only in embitterment, we have lost everything. So inside of our own natures, we have to sometimes, some way, evolve an understanding of the values that are emotional and mental sources of security. We all have a right to be thoughtful. We all have a right to have certain minor anxieties if need arises. But we should always have an anxiety that is pointed toward a solution. Whenever a problem arises in our lives, our first reaction should definitely be, what does this problem mean to me, and how can it make me a better person? If we can always think this way, we're not going to become neurotics. We are only going to become not neurotic if we believe that experience is unfair. But actually, what we think is unfair is challenge. We are here to grow. If we grow, we are happy. If we resist growth and fight against it, then misery sets in. So it's always best to try to transmute and transform negative aspects of personal attitudes into constructive ones by a simple action of the will. No great big fight, no tremendous struggle against everything that is inside of us, but simply a realization that we're here to learn, that if we can learn happily, we will be happy. If we cannot learn happily, we will be unhappy. But regardless of our attitudes, nature says we will ultimately learn. So it is best to do it joyfully in the first place. Now, there are times when it's not going to be easy, but if we are really sincere people, if our religion is more than simply a creedal denomination, if we really believe in the integrities of life, if we actually feel convinced in ourselves that we are part of a benevolent plan ruled over by an all-divine power, then we can take these problems and work with them. And by working with them in a reasonable manner, solve them. And by solving them immediately as they arise, we can go through life without scar tissue in the subconscious. We can go through life without developing a series of mental and emotional infirmities, which will become worse as we grow older, when we will have ever greater need for peace of mind. We can have it if we earn it. But as the Arabian Nights said, their happiness must be earned. The individual to be happy must keep the rules. The individual to be healthy must obey the laws. And a person who allows his mind or emotions to go to seed is bound to have trouble. But knowing this and realizing it, and knowing that we are equipped to combat this situation, and that there is always within us the power to transcend any debility that we may manifest, it is perfectly possible for us to day by day make those improvements in our own living by which we will prevent the closing in of this pressure of pain, psychological misery, mental headaches, and the resulting disabilities. Every attitude relates to some function of the body. There is something in us, an organ, a muscle, a nerve, a gland, an artery, or a vein, that particularly reacts to any mental or emotional excess that we have. Each one of our attitudes is symbolically represented in a body function. If these attitudes, therefore, become sick, the corresponding body function will be debilitated. And whatever attitude is not according to natural law, which affects our mental and emotional living, also affects our health, and gradually tears down our physical resistance. Therefore, it's not necessary just physically exercise in order to keep well. Jogging will not solve the emotional, mental problems. But mental and emotional jogging, an effort to exercise the faculties and emotions constructively, will help us to maintain health. The body will take care of itself reasonably well if the mind and emotions do not sicken it. So if there's anything wrong in the body, try, at first at least, to work with the emotions and mental attitudes. And if it's no longer possible to prevent the situation, then realize the tremendous dynamic advantage of adjusting to it constructively, idealistically, and hopefully, with strong faith and optimism concerning the immutability of growth in nature, and that in the end, all things will come out well. Well, time's up, folks.